Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Josh Yu.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we're going to talk about gambling. It is everywhere, and a new article in Christianity Today suggests there is a spiritual longing behind our gambling obsession. Also, as we look ahead to our Faith and Culture Deconstruction series, Pastor Josh and I are going to talk about deconstruction. What is it? Why do people do it? And how ought we to respond? All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Engaging Culture Podcast. Brian Kiley here with the birthday boy himself, Pastor Josh Utes.
Yep, today is my birthday and the time that we're recording this, obviously, and I am 43.
43?
And I don't feel a day over 50, so...
And nor do you look it.
Well, thank you, so, I think.
Josh and I and several of our staff just finished enjoying burritos for lunch for Josh's birthday. So we're going to see how much we burp during this episode.
You're welcome.
But it should be a good time. But Josh, tell me, other than it being your birthday, what was the best thing you saw this week?
Well, I have to follow up last episode's what happened in the hockey game.
Oh, obviously. Yes.
We won.
Yeah, you did.
We won the championship after being last place 90% of the season. And Brian can attest, the Banks character is real.
Oh my gosh. So real.
Yeah. Miles better than anybody else on the ice. And he ended up scoring 3 goals. We won 5-3, I think.
Yeah.
And it was an absolute blast. The team that we beat was in first place the entire season. They were super happy for us. No.
Not really.
Not really.
They sure didn't look like the first place team going against you guys.
No, they did not. But yeah, it was wild. Absolutely wild, but it was super fun.
Now, I was a spectator for this joyous occasion, and I enjoy going to people's events and supporting them. We often do that with, you know, our friends' kids and things like that. And I was excited about coming to the game, but also it had been kind of a long day. I preached at BYA that night. I had the like half second of like, I don't know, I'm tired, maybe I just want to go home. And I'm like, there'll probably be people there, it'll be fun, it'll, you know, see right. Josh and support him what he's doing. I'm so glad I came.
Oh, good.
It was a blast. It was so fun. And I knew that you were not nervous about the game, but you had low expectations.
Low
for the
expectations.
Game. And to walk in, I'm like, okay, they're ahead, 1-0. And there was, I don't know, what, probably like 8 or 9 other people from staff and their families there.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of people there supporting you, you know, we're cheering you on, having a good time. And just the joy of your whole team when you guys won. I'm like, this is awesome.
It was it was so uncharacteristic of me too. Like, cause I got really into it and I'll get really into some things, but I'm pretty like middle of the road about everything in life, which makes me a real joy to hang out with. But like, I just don't like express that kind of like energy all the time. And by the end of it, I was just like, oh my gosh, I didn't think we were going to win literally until there's 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
And we were up 5-2 at that point. I was like, oh my gosh, we're actually going to win.
Going to win this thing.
Because I just kept waiting for them to just come back and turn it on and take us out.
Yeah.
I think Pastor Ashley's favorite part is me getting a penalty at the end of the game.
We were all very excited about that, especially her. Yes.
And then young Piper White started chanting, "Let Josh out."
And we joined in.
And you guys joined in. And
we sure did.
So I could get out of the penalty box for a little while. But yes, it was very fun. We are champions forever and ever. And we're off to an 0-1 start this season.
Wow, the new season's already started.
Already.
Oh my gosh.
There was no break this time. So we're just already into it.
I guess no break if you make it to the championship game.
Correct. Yeah.
Love it. Love it. All right. Well, congratulations again.
What about you? What's your best
thing? So this last Friday, my wife and I took our boys to see the comedian Brian Regan, which if you have not heard of Brian Regan, respectfully, where have you been the last 20 years? But I have been a fan of Brian Regan since I think I first remember hearing about him in college. And to be honest, I didn't need to go see him again. I've probably seen him at least 5 times, which I can only think of one other comedian I've seen twice. So I've seen him plenty, but my kids have never been to live comedy. And my oldest son watching funny things with him.
Oh yeah,
is almost better than the thing itself.
100%.
Because he laughs so joyfully and uproariously, and it's just he's a pretty easy kid to make laugh. So Brian Regan was actually better than I thought. The last time I saw him, I thought it was like, okay, you know, end of his career. He's kind of winding down a little. I thought he was funny. I enjoyed him very much. But what I enjoyed even more was sitting next to my son and just watching him, you know, lose his mind. That's the so entire great. Time.
Yeah,
we had a great time. I was up at Hard Rock in Sacramento, which, as we'll discover in the next segment, I hate casinos, but we were able to sneak on in, enjoy the show, and get out of there. It was a great time.
Yeah, we took Declan to see Brian Regan because he loves comedy just this last year. And him laughing, like, I don't even remember the jokes that were going on, but him laughing hysterically in there was worth every penny.
Worth every penny.
We absolutely loved it.
Oh, that's great. I'll have to get them together and watch them watch something.
Yes.
All right. Sounds weird when you say it that way. All right, we'll be right back. We are back, and it is no secret that the world of gambling has exploded in recent years. What was once contained to casinos and sports books in places like Nevada and New Jersey is now found via an ever-increasing number of smartphone apps. Not only can anyone, virtually anywhere, gamble on sports using apps like FanDuel and DraftKings, prediction markets like Polymarket and Kalshi have now made it possible to gamble on just about anything. For example, right now on Polymarket, you can bet on anything from who will win the 2026 World Cup, to whether the Fed will raise interest rates in 2026, to whether the U.S. government will confirm that aliens exist by a certain date, and the list goes on. You can bet on how many times Elon Musk will tweet next week.
It's wild.
It's just crazy. America is essentially one big casino. In fact, I read an article in The Atlantic this week written by somebody who was basically paid by The Atlantic to be a degenerate sports gambler for a year and write about it, and I thought it was interesting. He wrote about how at the end of the piece, or excuse me, the end of the year, he went to Vegas, and that experience helped him see the wisdom in, quote, confining gambling to places that make you feel a little bit bad about yourself, which I thought was funny.
That's a great line.
Which, side note, Josh, when I was in college, a group of my friends went to Vegas and invited me to go. I couldn't go because I'd already made plans with my dad to go hike the Grand Canyon. And I'm not sure what year this was, but I think this is year 23. Where I have a perfect record of non-attendance with the rest of my college buddies going to Vegas. I have never been, not even once. They were just there last week because I hate Las Vegas. I don't want to go.
Anyway. The only draw to Vegas is that there are some like nice restaurants there. However, there are nice restaurants everywhere else as well, and so I choose the everywhere else.
Everywhere else, yeah, that is true. So, crazy stats for those of you who aren't in kind of gambling world. Since 2018, Americans have wagered more than $500 billion on sports, and roughly half of men ages 18 to 49 have an active account with an online sports book. 60% of adults have gambled at least once in the last year, and fully 22% of sports betting app users have reported problematic gambling behavior. Aforementioned sites like Polymarket process $6 billion in quote-unquote trades every week. I say quote-unquote because it's just betting. It's gambling. And that is a 1,000% increase from a few years ago. And what's really crazy to me, Josh, is we're not just betting on games and silly stuff. We're able to bet on life and death world events. In fact, right before the United States invaded Venezuela and captured Nicolas Maduro, someone on Polymarket wagered a significant amount of money that Maduro would be in the United States by the end of January. Sure enough, that individual made $400,000. Now, I've got some concerns about normal gambling, but man, this takes it to a whole different level.
Yeah, the idea that we can start placing bets on what's happening around us, no matter what it is, whether it's the weather and rain precipitation or just the way somebody tweets or how much they tweet or how many characters they use in their last, like, just that finite amount, or not infinite, but that minuscule, like, detail that you can now bet, it's just wild to me.
Yeah.
because I can't imagine actually placing money on any of it. Just personally, like I've never bet. I've never been into it. I've never bought a lottery ticket. Never bought a scratch. Like I just have never participated. Yeah. In that, just because if I spend money, I'd rather spend it on something else. Now I have played poker, but I spent the same amount of money that I would go see a movie.
Yeah.
Like it's a $20 buy-in. Well, I would spend that at the movie theater. Yeah. Like, okay, like that's not really the same thing.
And you're there with friends. It's a social experience.
You're paying for
the entertainment, so to speak.
Right. So I have done that, but other than that, like this idea of betting on events around like is just so foreign to me.
Yeah.
Like I can't even imagine why anybody does it, but it's a giant market.
It is. And sort of the allure of being in on the action and being able to have sort of some risk involved and potential reward, that is a very, very addicting thing. Now, even when it just comes to sports gambling, it's created a situation where more and more people are watching sports, not as fans, but as bettors with a piece of the action. What's the problem that comes with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of perceived luck or influence on something, and people are placing their hopes into something that is not under their control and is definitely not of the Lord.
Yeah.
And the problem with this is that they begin to start chasing something that is not even close to being something that they can actually contribute to or have any influence over, and is just purely just driven by some insatiable need of some kind.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And we're going to get into kind of the other article I read that talks about the spiritual element of it. I mean, I think it fundamentally changes the way we engage with so many things in the world.
Right.
More serious things, as we've discussed. But even sports. I mean, I had this experience. My kids and I were at a basketball game. And a couple rows behind us, there were some dudes in their 20s, just whatever. They're there. They're having a good time. And one of them had money on a particular player scoring a particular number of points. He needed like 8 or something. So the entire fourth quarter of this game, this dude is like screaming from the upper deck, "Get the ball to Hartenstein! Get the ball to Hartenstein!" Oh my! And in the course of listening to what he was saying, he stood to win like $200 if Hartenstein got to 8 points.
Right.
And the whole time, he and his buddies are like freaking out about, "Oh my gosh, this guy needs to score. Oh, why is he such a bum? Oh my gosh, go buy the basket. What are you doing?" Just like clearly so stressed out about
this one guy.
And I literally like turned to my boys and I was like, "Boys, this is what happens to you when you get..." I was ready to pay the guy to thank him for the lesson he taught my children. And Hartenstein did not get 8 points. He did not get his $200. Yeah. But it creates this angst and this level of fervor over money that, I mean, you know, you and I are both sports fans.
Right.
I still think we have a problematic level of attention we pay to sports just on 100%. Their own. But you add that gambling element. And I'll just, like you, I've never been that into gambling. The only times I've been to a casino in the last 5 years is when I have to walk through one to get to a show like Brian Regan or something like that. And even that, I don't really enjoy. I've never in my life bet money directly on the outcome of a sporting event. And several years ago, I swore off all sports-related gambling altogether because I found even if I do like little daily fantasy games for $1, the amount of attention it took from me. I was like, I don't like this. I don't want this. So I swore it off completely. And, you know, I'll do a March Madness pool with some friends and a fantasy football league with some friends. But that's about it. And all of this to say, any sports-related gambling I've done has always been very, very low stakes. But part of the reason why I don't do it is I see the potential for addiction. Mm. I've never been truly addicted to anything, but I am self-aware enough to know I have a pretty addictive personality. And the idea of getting in on the action and getting really consumed by that, man, I can see the danger of it. And that's a big reason why, even though for the most part, my view most of my life had been, well, you know, if you like gambling and you're doing it on a budget and it's not affecting your life, like, go for it. I don't know. Right. That view has shifted for me quite a bit as I've seen the real world harm that gambling does for gamblers. And we haven't even talked about players and athletes and, I mean, athletes literally getting sent Venmo bills by gamblers after the game saying, "You owe me because you didn't perform." I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, and it's doing more damage in families than I think people recognize, that it's not just the individual that's suffering, but there's actual families that are suffering from this. And the way that addiction works is that it begins to feel like you're in control and you think you can control it all the time, to one day you realize you've lost everything and you can't control this anymore.
Yep.
And that's, if you're lucky, you discover that early.
Yep.
If you're normal, you discover it too late.
Yep.
And we're inviting something into our lives that is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
To me, this is a rough analogy, and I get that. But it's like handing a 5-year-old a loaded weapon and just being like, all right, but as long as you don't pull the trigger, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? It's like,
just, we're not capable of handling it safely. Yeah.
No, we're just not mature enough to understand what this thing is.
Yeah.
And I think what we're learning right now is that the gambling is a loaded weapon.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see it like, oh, this actually has really dark sides to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of in light of all of that, that's why I was so fascinated by this article I came across in Christianity Today last week called The Secret Prayers of Gamblers, Locating the Spiritual Longing Hiding in America's Obsession with Betting. And we'll link to it in the show notes. And it's pretty long, but it's worth reading. And what's interesting about the article is that the author doesn't like paint gambling as a moral problem or a greed problem. He says that it's evidence of a deeper spiritual crisis. Mm. He argues that gamblers are seeking some sort of connection to something beyond themselves through the thrill that comes from risking and winning. And what's really interesting is he says people are seeking sort of some evidence that the universe sees them. Oh, I picked my lucky numbers and they hit, things like that. And he even goes so far as to compare it to other pagan spiritual practices, tarot cards, mm-hmm. crystals, things like that. I don't know. Do you buy that? In what sense can gambling be a spiritual act?
I think I do buy it because I think a lot of gambling has this act of my hope and my fortune and my future is really dependent on this unseen thing.
Yeah.
It's this spiritual realm. It's this concept that floats in the ether. And if I am in good karma, I will get lucky enough to have this thing come in. I mean, the whole concept of luck has like pagan roots where yeah. it's, you know, if I put enough positive energy in the world, I should receive it back. And I can actually influence my future by worshiping this thing. We wouldn't call it worshiping. We call it placing a bet. You know, they're investing into this ideology or idolatry rather.
Yeah.
They're investing into this idolatry and expecting something to come back that benefits their lives.
Yeah.
That's a very spiritual act. We should be doing that with the Lord.
Right.
Like if we're saying, hey, we're spending time in prayer and we are going to God for our fortunes and for our futures, we would call that good Christianity.
We call that prayer.
Yeah. We call that normal. That's a spiritual discipline. We're going to something other than God. That is now idolatry.
Yeah, absolutely. And an interesting kind of angle the author took on this was he cited kind of all these statistics, of course, where kind of organized religion, quote unquote, is declining in the United States. But that what has not been lost is our sense of longing. And he says that America, even with the decline of organized religion, it has not become a nation of secularists and empiricists, believing only in what we can see, touch, and taste. Instead, there is, he calls, an effusion of esoterica and reenchantment, which is a heck of a turn of phrase right
yeah.
there. And he says how the country is awash in experiments with cosmic connection, grounding, crystals, yogas, chakras, channeling, astrology, and more. People are playing with and trying on different ideas of ultimate meaning and attempting to tap into the order of the universe to experience personal fullness. And I thought it was really interesting, Josh, that he places gambling in that same category, saying it is an attempt to meet this longing that, again, is meant to be fulfilled through Christ, but does not disappear if we sort of reject that. We just end up seeking to find it someplace else. And I guess I'd never really thought of gambling quite in that way, but it makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I think he's totally right. But what do you think that longing like gets down into? I know it's supposed to be for Christ, but if you are a gambler and you're chasing after this, what would you say is driving you towards this?
And I think that's where I was so fascinated by the argument that was being made here, because it is so easy to think about gambling as greed. Mm-hmm. And as I've observed different things, as I've seen people that I know that gamble a lot, as I've, on the limited times I am in a casino, like, casinos just make me so sad. It's just, you know, people seemingly like plugged into their machines and just kind of dead in the eyes and the whole thing. And I think what is desired there is not actually money. That what is desired is some sort of connection, some sort of sign of significance. And I think that desire to be seen and to be known and to be loved and to be validated is so deep in each and every one of us that I think if we're disconnected from the Lord, we will seek that in all sorts of different places and not even realize we're doing it. Mm-hmm. I don't think if you look at somebody who's addicted to gambling and you ask them, why are you doing this? They're not going to say, well, I'm searching for transcendence and validation.
Right.
But I don't know. I think there's something there. That's what's going on. I was really struck by, he talked about this idea of gambling as wild, misdirected prayer, which kind of relates to what I'm talking about here, about this idea of kind of transcendence. I want to talk about this for a second. How does viewing any sort of vice or addiction, whether it's gambling or something else, through that lens as like a manifestation of this deep longing for God rather than just a simple moral failure, how does that shift the way that we think about it?
I think that helps us look at the symptoms and the root causes of things. Oftentimes, we will struggle with a behavior, and that behavior what we're drawn to is really just a symptom of a much deeper problem.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that this highlights for us is that if we start to see it through a longing for God, we start to realize that it's where we're placing our hope, it's where we're placing our trust, but it's also, what are we afraid of? How are we not trusting God? How are we not actually fully connecting with the Lord? Like it begins to expose the deeper funk in our lives that, you know, we really have to deal with, because we can keep treating behaviors all we want, but we will replace one bad behavior with another bad behavior. You see this in recovery ministries a lot, I gave up alcohol. Now they're chain smoking to help deal with the alcohol stuff. I gave up meth. Good. But now they've replaced that with a different type of addiction. One that's not going to cost them their family and lives. Great. But it's still another addiction that instead of dealing with the root cause, a lot of times they're just replacing it with something different.
Yeah.
And that is not, that is ultimately not helpful. And I think if we begin to view gambling in the same way of, gambling is a symptom of a much deeper problem.
Yeah.
We begin to actually get to the core pieces of things.
And I think it helps us deal more compassionately with some
Absolutely.
Of this. And I'm not an addiction expert, so I want to tread very carefully here. I'm not an expert in the mechanics of how addiction works, but I do think I know enough to know that it's pretty problematic if we only treat them as, oh, it's sort of some sort of moral deficiency.
Right.
That again, as somebody who has seen like addictive tendencies in myself. There are zero games on my phone, not because I think having games on your phone is wrong, but because I cannot handle it. Mm-hmm. I will play them too much, right? I have those tendencies in myself, and so I can understand how someone can get sort of lost in those things.
Yeah.
And it helps us to see, okay, there's actually a longing here that we can really validate. And I think to think of it as a misdirected longing is really, really helpful. Just last thing as we wrap up, gosh, I mean, the end of the article was really, really haunting to me, where the author talked about being in a casino and he's looking around and he's observing kind of these signs of longing, as he put it. And he talked about seeing the lonely dealer there, you know, shuffling the cards, which I've certainly seen that before. The person who has seemingly become one with her slot machine, the man in the parking lot with the scratcher. And he says this, he says, so much gambling, so much restless desire, Lord, hear our prayer. And I guess I just want to wrap with this idea to go that, number one, if we struggle with gambling ourselves, to really pay attention to what is that restless desire in us, and how might God want to meet us in that moment. And then if we're around people who gambling has gotten a hold of them, to recognize that there is a restless desire there, that ultimately what they need is not a moralistic lecture. They don't need to be shamed for what they're doing, but they do need to have that longing sort of validated and spoken to, and ultimately, whereas opportunities present themselves, to kind of redirect someone towards Jesus who can actually fulfill those longings, right?
Absolutely. And I think about the addict that is really struggling, mm-hmm. and if it's purely about behaviors, you can just white knuckle your way through it.
Yeah.
But if we really see it for what it is, that yeah. there is something so much deeper,
yeah.
and there's something so much more profound that needs to be dealt with
yeah.
in their lives, that we as believers should come alongside folks more and not chastise them for their behaviors, but come alongside and it's like, hey, there's some, you are longing for something, and like, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
What is this fulfilling in your life that you think is good for you? What do you like about this? What are you enjoying? Are you happier because you started gambling? I don't know a single gambler that does it. I mean, there's some that just do it on the side, whatever.
Right.
And like, I'm talking more those who are really into it that seem happy to me.
Totally.
Like their lives seem really consumed by. They don't hit that number, and then they're kind of panicking. Like, I was kind of depending on that to pay for groceries.
Yep.
And, I was doing it. Like, that is a rough place to be. And yep. I think as believers, we can be more compassionate, but also begin to point people back to Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're struggling with gambling and you identify problematic gambling behaviors in yourself, first of all, just want to encourage you, number one, like, bring that to the Lord. Number two, bring it into the light with other people. I think part of the insidious nature of all of this, it's so easy to do it all in secret.
Yeah.
And just recognize there is a longing there, and God wants to meet you in the midst of that. And I just think we bring these things into the light. We bring them to Him. We bring them to trusted people, and you know, engage with the kind of resources in our society that exist to help with this. And that's where we can begin to find healing. We'll be right back.
We're going to move into our next segment about the concept of deconstruction. There's a cultural movement over the last decade or so that has people publicly processing their faith through a process called deconstruction. As with most cultural movements, how it started versus where we are now has shifted over the years to mean many different things. And so today, I want to spend some time defining what deconstruction is, what it isn't, and why people deconstruct based on research data. Well, anecdotal data is fine. There is good practices for research data-driven conversations. And so we're going to focus in on a little bit of that. But before we get into that, I want to share a short part of my experience with deconstruction and what that process looked like for me. A little over 8 years ago, my wife and I left our church in Nevada. I needed to step off staff. There's a lot of things going on, and the turmoil and conflict and the hurt that was there really led both of us into questioning not our faith per se, but how our faith is practiced. Mm-hmm. And so my personal experience with deconstruction was not about, is God real? Is God loving? Is Jesus real? Is Jesus loving? It was purely, is this what the church that God has designed us to be? And is this worth living for?
Yeah.
Those were the questions. And so that process looked very different for me than it did for my wife. For me, it was meeting with people that I can just say anything to and them not panic. Or there are people who they had already left churches, and so they were already on the other side. Now, my wife was very cautious with one of my friends. She said, hey, he's very anti the church. And so just be careful. Like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater as you go through this. But she and I both have permission from each other and from the friends around us to really take a look at, does this is this really reflective of the kingdom that God wants to build? Yeah. And so we spent a long time kind of going through that, and Bridgeway played a huge role in healing for that. Mm-hmm. For me, I came back onto staff after going through a short deconstruction process. Like, okay, the church is fine. The people stink, but the church as God has designed it is good.
Yeah.
I just need to find a church so that I trust the leadership, and I won't choose a church based on where I get a job, but where we can just be. Yeah. And the first weekend that we were here, Pastor Lance is sharing a section out of Job, and it was his friends kind of back-talking and like pulling things away, which is really my exact story. And I just sat there weeping yeah. as he's reading my mail to the entire church. And I ended up, and I attended the 4 p.m. Saturday service. I ended up coming back to both Sunday services the next day. And we still lived in Nevada at the time. And it was just because it's like, I felt like God was speaking directly to me. Wow. And that began a processing. So when we moved back to California, I was like, we're going to go to Bridgeway because I feel like this is the place that we can heal. Now, luckily, I was able to be hired. And credit to Pastor Brian and Pastor Lance and the elder board, which, because I did not hide the hurt during my interview process. I was pretty open about it. But they took me on as a healing project anyway and allowed me to go through that when I first got back in. And so it really was a redemptive story for me, and because God reconstructed what was going on. Do you have a deconstruction moment of your life?
Less specifically, and I mean, your story is obviously really powerful and just really cool how God has redeemed that in so many ways, and just the blessing that you and your family have brought to so many of us personally and to Bridgeway as an organization. I mean, I think, you know, growing up evangelical as a teenager in the 90s, became a Christian in high school and sort of was given the whole evangelical package, you know, and that was great. And I'm really grateful for it. But I look at my life now and there are things, I mean, shoot, I have a memory of giving a persuasive speech in college about a theological topic I no longer believe, right? Mm. I have let go of a lot of beliefs of my childhood that I'd say, no, I don't think that's quite right. And I always joked, like so many of my Christian high school friends in high school who are Christians, I didn't go to a Christian high school, who were raised in the church, like went who knows where after high school. And I was said, like, I have my life without Jesus. That was the first 15 years. I don't need to go do that.
Right.
So there was never a time where I walked away from my faith. But my spiritual journey has been one of construction, deconstruction, reconstruction, and I'm better off for it. So I Absolutely. Think there are ways deconstruction can be really helpful.
Absolutely. So we can't go any further without actually defining what spiritual deconstruction actually is. So when you're looking at reels on TikTok or Instagram and you have people who are doing a deconstruction thing, they can mean a thousand different things. Yeah. And so we want to get real clear on what we mean. So a simple definition of deconstruction is that deconstruction is the process of examining, questioning, and reevaluating one's beliefs about God, faith, and the church, often by pulling apart what was previously assumed or inherited. So assumed and inherited, some of that inheriting can just be what you were taught as a kid.
Yeah.
You didn't get to choose the theological bent of the church that you grew up in. Your parents chose that for you, right. You know, that was given to you. And so there's a couple of things that are really important to note. Deconstruction is not new. Right. We actually see it in scripture. It's not called deconstruction. It's called the book of Job. but in the book of Job, you know, Job is struggling with what is happening, where the Lord gives, God gives Satan the ability to attack Job and essentially ruin his life.
Yeah.
And Job struggles with the suffering that God allows.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is that as Job processes this with the Lord, God responds.
Yeah.
But God does not rebuke him for asking questions. he rebukes him for the conclusions that he kind of came to.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, where were you? You know,
yeah.
He corrects Job's conclusions, but he doesn't correct Job's honesty.
Yeah.
God created space for Job to process with him.
Absolutely. And if I can just interject real quick, I have a tab open on my browser right now. Article is called Jesus Was Reconstructing Before You, or excuse me, Jesus Was Deconstructing Before You Were. And the author kind of makes the argument that a lot of Jesus's interactions with the Pharisees could be interpreted as acts of deconstruction.
100%.
Insofar as he was sort of attacking really unhealthy belief systems that had sort of gotten their way into their mindset.
Absolutely. Deconstruction is often triggered when faith and lived experiences stop aligning. This is a really important piece, that when deconstruction happens, it comes at a moment of crisis.
Yeah.
And that's not because people like freak out, like, well, I'm having crisis, therefore I'm going to deconstruct. It's more of the crisis has revealed an inconsistency within their faith, or an inconsistency of their understanding of faith or their understanding of God, and that that misalignment causes a lot of friction.
This, by the way, is part of why good theology matters so much.
Absolutely.
I have not been through a capital T traumatic experience in my life. Plenty of little t, but no capital T. And I'm aware of that could happen at any time. And if and when that happens, it will be horrific, right? And if our theology does not give us an understanding that God does not protect us from real life, and this is a life of suffering, which the Bible makes very clear, it is only going to compound sort of the crisis of the traumatic. It's going to create a spiritual crisis on top of that.
Yeah.
And I could give lots of other examples, but I think so often our crises of faith are rooted in bad theology to begin with.
Yes.
And that is something that, man, if we only are sort of noticing that in the moment of crisis, that can be tough.
Absolutely. Deconstruction also involves asking three really important questions. What do I actually believe? Why do I believe it?
Yeah.
Which is crucial.
Yep.
What is culture versus what is biblical?
Yeah.
Deconstruction is a process and is not a destination.
Yeah.
And so it's really those three questions, I think, are really, really important for us to wrestle with. The why piece is really, really important. But Pastor Brian, the question about what is cultural versus biblical, how do you see that within the church context?
I mean, that is such an important question, because when we are in a Christian environment, there are many spaces where cultural beliefs, cultural assumptions, beliefs about things that actually have nothing to do with the Bible get sort of imported into the culture in a manner where it can be really difficult to discern what is truly Christian and what is not. And when I say what is not, I don't mean that it's like anti-Christian.
No.
I don't mean that it's pagan. I just mean that it's not like the core of what Christianity is. And I think so often a lot of what prompts deconstruction is not a challenge with, say, the fundamentals of the Christian faith. Like, yes, that does happen. I don't want to say that it doesn't. But it ends up being with things like, my church got too political. Well, shame on your church. Like, I should say that more compassionately to the person.
Right.
Man, I'm really sorry. Like, shame on your church for letting worldly politics get in. So, yes, let's reject that.
Right.
Let's reject the use of the pulpit for political purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But that actually doesn't mean you need to reject Jesus.
Right.
Oh, my pastor or the Christian personality I like was revealed they're getting rich and swindling money and doing all this stuff. Like, okay, that's terrible. And a culture, I'm all for a culture of honor, a culture that is so quote unquote honoring that our pastors are becoming millionaires. Like, that's a problem, but you don't need to reject Jesus. So that idea of going, yes, there's plenty of things we can reject that don't cause us to reject our faith. I mean, that is the story of my life.
Yeah. The way that I kind of view when it comes down to the church is, are we talking about the method or are we talking about the theology of it? Connect cards and cafes and worship with lights and sound systems, these are all methods.
Yep.
These are all methods to help us do different things that are a part of the Christian faith. Connect cards help with community. Cafes help with community and connection. The worship and lights help create atmospheres that are different than our everyday lives to signal to us it's time for us to do something important and focus in on the Lord. Like, yeah, there are things that are really good about that, yeah, but if those are the driving forces, like, let's put the methods over in one box and put our theology in a different box.
Even the idea of just saying, okay, if those are offensive to you, okay.
Right.
Like, you don't need to walk away from Jesus.
No.
Walk away from a church that does those things and find one that doesn't. Great. Right. Like, you don't need to deconstruct your whole kind of Christian understanding on account of it.
Yeah. So, but getting into what deconstruction is not, there's some really important distinctions here.
Yeah.
What it's not is it's not automatically abandoning Christianity. And this is what we're seeing more of in the social media sphere and the different reels and different things that people are doing to become influencers in the deconstruction movement type of a thing, where it's, this is why I abandoned Christianity. And when you get down into it, it's like they only did part of a process. That is not what a full deconstruction is. Deconstruction is not rebellion for the sake of rebellion.
Yeah.
Of like, hey, give me permission to do whatever I want. It's not intellectual enlightenment. It's not proof that someone was also never really a Christian.
Yeah.
And it's not actually always healthy.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we're going to be talking about at our Faith and Culture Deconstruction seminars is that there's a really important second phase, and that is reconstruction.
Yeah.
And that reconstruction is really pivotal to whether or not this was healthy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like going in for surgery where they open you up and they take out the bad thing, but then they don't close the wound,
yeah,
so you can heal.
Yeah.
And they're like, all right, we did the surgery. It's like, oh, great, you took out my appendix, but you haven't sewn anything back up. Like,
right,
that's not better. Like, okay, you got to complete the process. Like,
yeah,
there needs to be something to complete.
Yeah. That's absolutely right, and I think deconstruction, when it's honest and when it's I think on some level affirmed and not shamed,
yeah,
and when it is truly a reexamination of one's beliefs, can lead to something very healthy and can lead to a more robust faith. That has certainly been my own experience. If the deconstruction is this sense of I'm reacting to something negative that I saw, or there's sort of a showmanship about it, which I think if you're going online and needing to tell the world about your deconstruction, I would question your motives there a little,
yeah,
bit. Like, are we trying to kind of put on a little bit of a show here for folks? I don't know, but that sure is what it looks like. When it's that kind of thing, then it's, I don't know, we're following trends, we're trying to look a certain kind of way,
right,
or do that. But I think, again, when it's done well and when it's healthy and when it is honest in that it is truly a reexamination, it can be beneficial.
Absolutely. And the goal is to reconstruct on what is true.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
And it may look different than the theology of your parents. It may look different than the theology of the church that you attend.
Yeah.
And you know, we want to be a part of your deconstruction process as a church, but we also know that if we are at the center of some of the church hurt, we might not be the best place for that.
Yeah.
And there are other churches that might lead down a different road, but it's totally fine. Like, it's the process is what is true. Like,
yeah,
how do we get back to who God is and getting back into that?
Yeah.
So there's top reported reasons why people deconstruct. One of the most common, this is from Barna and Pew, and there's also some anecdotal pieces, which anecdotal stuff is valuable, but it's not data.
Yeah.
So, well, my friend told me, fine, that's your friend, but
it's their experience.
It's their experience.
But it's
that
not
does,
data. Yeah.
But that's not data. You know, you need over lots and lots of people, and Barna and Pew do phenomenal research. One of the top ones was church hurt and hypocrisy that they see in the church, whether that's leaders' moral failings, that's experiencing judgment, or seeing the exclusion of others. We see this within the LGBTQ community. You know, they're being excluded from things because of that identity that they're carrying. Like, there's a lot of that in there that has led to church hurt. That's not to affirm anything. You know, like, as if you listen to our message this weekend, we're not an affirmation church, but we are very loving and we want to be welcoming.
Yeah.
And so there's that part. There's a perceived gap between the teaching of the church and the lived behavior of the church. Yeah. If this is Christianity, I don't want it type of responses.
And it's, I hear about stuff like this, and I just, I have a lot of compassion for people that end up in this space. Like, I don't really blame them. Like, yeah. I am pro pastor through and through. Unless you're going to have a huge moral failing and you're going to hurt people, then I like, do right. not look to me for support, man. You are abusing your office, and that's like, you know. And I look at these marginalized communities who, again, our theological position has been used to justify harshness or judgment or meanness. Like, that's terrible. And like, yeah. that's on us if we are creating that. And certainly for those of us who teach, to be able to go, I'm you know, this is for you and not for me. Man, I don't blame people for rejecting that. And I would say all of those things ought to be rejected. And I'll tell you who I think would be in the front of the line rejecting those things is Jesus.
Absolutely. One of the number two answers was unanswered questions or intellectual tensions, being unsatisfied with science versus faith conversations, yeah. The reliability of the Bible. What does inspired word actually mean? What does inerrant actually mean? Those kinds of pieces. Feeling like theology is overly simplistic. Because God can do whatever he wants. So that's my trump card is I can, well, because God. Yeah. And then that's the end of every conversation. Like, that's not helpful.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no space to wrestle with doubts without judgment. Yeah. Now, this idea that the church is afraid of doubt is huge. When I was coming up in churches, especially in high school, is a really big apologetics movement at that time.
Yep.
And it was all about defending your faith against the ills of science primarily.
Yep.
And it was really about if you had any doubt, you might not be able – don't say that because, you know, you're not actually a Christian. If you don't – is God's word not true? It's like God's word is true, and it's inerrant. I don't think my understanding's inerrant. I don't think your understanding's inerrant. I think we can still wrestle with this, and that no room for doubt causes a lot of people to just walk away.
If we're shaming honest questions, like, what does that say about us? Is our faith not robust enough to work through the mess and challenge of honest questions? Once again, I look at like people who deconstruct because they are given these simplistic answers. I'm like, okay, you don't need to, but also I don't blame you for being frustrated.
You.
That just quick side note. One of the reasons I'm so grateful for my theological education at Fuller was you're exposed to like every version of Christian you can imagine.
Yeah.
And you just wrestle with all sorts of different ideas. And I just found it to be very sort of intellectually stimulating and helping me to kind of clarify my own beliefs while at the same time having an open hand towards others who would think differently and allowing my views to be changed as I engaged in scripture and I engaged with church history. Yeah. All of that, like, this is a process we ought to be promoting, and 100%. Especially with our young people, if they care enough to doubt, like doubt for real, not just like I don't want to go to church, mm-hmm. like let's affirm that and walk through the mess with them and honor them enough to really wrestle with the questions with like Jesus can handle it, y'all. Like,
yeah,
get off my soapbox now.
Yes. You know, we look at the stories of doubting Thomas that get thrown into this of like, look how Jesus like reprimands Thomas. It's all about the tone in which you read into Jesus's voice there.
Totally.
That, and I think a lot of us grew up with this tone is super negative from Jesus to Thomas versus I think it might have been just compassionate and recognizing where Thomas was at that moment. It's like, hey, you need to put your fingers in the holes. Here they are.
Yep.
You need to do that. Here they are.
Yep.
You're doubting. I'm meeting you in your doubt. And I think that's where Jesus wants to meet us. He wants to meet us in our doubt and not have us solve our doubts before we meet him.
Yep.
I think that's crucial. Yeah. The number three reason was political and cultural disillusionment, that faith becoming entangled with political identity, feeling like Christianity is being used as a tool rather than truth. That was huge. Number four, personal suffering or trauma. So the theology of suffering was a big piece, and we'll spend a big chunk of time, or at least a chunk of time in our Faith and Culture series on this, in that loss, injustice, abuse, disappointment, and in God or with God, prayers that seem to go unanswered, why there's suffering in this world, all of these things. If God is so good, why does this happen? Yeah. That big question. And then some of the other pieces were, you know, shallow faith formation built on rules instead of relationship. I refer to this as the 90s behavior modification movement. That's a Josh-ism. Brian has probably heard me say this 8 billion times.
Well, no, I'm just laughing because that was, you know, late 90s youth group. I'm
it was.
Right there with you.
It was. And so it was this whole if you had sex, you were going to hell type of mentality. Like, you couldn't possibly be a Christian and do this. Like, it was so much against your behaviors, which is so, like, did you read the story of David? I'm not saying he's an example for us to follow. I'm just saying.
I believe sex is for marriage, and that is what I'd advocate for those who are following Christ.
Absolutely.
And I have a, you know, conservative view on LGBTQ issues, but my goodness, if we've raised a generation of kids in the 90s who didn't know the gospel but knew they shouldn't have sex until they were married and that you can't be gay, I'm like, what are we doing here? Anyway, I'm all up on my soapboxes here today.
Yes.
Josh, you're triggering me with these things.
Apparently. And then there's the last one, and this is one that doesn't get said enough, is that there's a desire for autonomy. And I think that comes from an okay place. And what I mean by a desire of autonomy is that people don't want to feel like they're just a part of a machine. And I think churches have treated people as methods. Yeah. And, you know, a means to an end, and their end, and let's grow the organization and let's make this organization great. So there's this race to be a mega church in the early 2000s, and it really all became about who had the largest church and how do we grow to be the largest church. And even as a large church ourselves, it's not the size of the church that became the problem.
Yeah.
It was the motivation behind it and how people were used, abused, and spit out because of that.
100%.
There's a tension there that people don't want to be just used to grow somebody else's vision.
Yeah.
And I think there's that desire for autonomy of, I want to be seen as an individual, which I think is an actually healthy spot. Where it becomes unhealthy is when it becomes I want to live my life according to my preferences and my principles, not the Lord's principles. Yeah. That's where it starts to get, okay, now we're trying to justify life.
Yeah, I like you, have seen plenty of examples of churches using people, and that's no good. I do think the element of this, and you alluded to it, that is actually very unhealthy, that I think the gospel at its core would really challenge, is this idea of I am an autonomous individual and I'm accountable to no one.
Yeah.
It really fights against kind of the individualist mood that has sort of taken over culturally in the last several decades. And that is where I think it is really dangerous that we go, okay, part of my deconstruction is I actually want to withdraw from community. I want to withdraw from accountability. I want to withdraw from people who are in my life. And I want to withdraw from this idea that I am responsible for my actions and the manner in which I live, both to my friends and neighbors and to God. If we withdraw from that, that is really, really dangerous. And the continual invitation of, I think, just Christian practice is that we are better in community. That is how we grow. That is how we're discipled. Right. That is how we're healthy. And when our desire for autonomy is greater than our desire for that, that's a problem.
Absolutely. So as we're kind of wrapping up here, so if you are finding yourself in a deconstruction zone of life, if you're in that that area, number one, you are not alone. Number two, it can be healthy if you stay in community, as Pastor Brian was saying. If you begin to isolate and pull away from everyone, then it goes into really unhealthy practices really, really quickly, and you won't recognize it necessarily right off the bat. And so I really encourage you to stay connected with folks. We want to be a place that you can process whether or not you feel like God is real. Still would love to process that with you. Struggling with who Jesus says he is, great. Let's talk about that. Let's get into that. Struggling with, can we trust the Bible? Fantastic question. we should wrestle with that. Let's get into these things. You know, we want to be a place that you are free to have those questions and to bring those things up and not be judged or put into a box of like, well, that's just a really dangerous thing to think. Like, yeah. No, it's more dangerous to not deal with these questions. And so we want to be a place to that. But I also really want to encourage you to come be a part of this deconstruction series. And if you have not deconstructed and you're not in one, I still encourage you to be a part of this series because when we do this Faith and Culture on Deconstruction, you're going to learn a lot about it, but you'll also begin to have empathy and sympathy for others who are going through it and learn, get some good skills on how to walk alongside those who are deconstructing. And so our Faith and Culture Deconstruction will begin on April 12th through May 3rd on Sunday evenings from 6:30 to 8 o'clock. It might go a little bit later depending on different things. There are 45 minutes or so sessions with a break in the middle. Registration is not required, but it is appreciated for our planning purposes. There is a link in the show notes, so you can go directly there. We would love to see you at our Faith and Culture Deconstruction.
Well, we're back, and we are going to end the show with a game we haven't done in a while that is called Blessed or Stressed, where Pastor Josh and myself are going to share something from the world that we have come across, and the other will say if we are blessed or stressed by this thing, this product, this idea, this trend, whatever. We have not told each other about these in advance, so here we go. Josh, I don't know if you're aware of this. The Christian AI market is getting crowded. There are lots of AI options in the Christian space. And new to the scene is a product called Creed, which bills itself as, quote, a digital companion for churches and believers. The founder of Creed says that the product is Tamagotchi meets Duolingo for Christians. And he says, think of it as your best friend and your youth pastor in your pocket that you can talk to about any questions, be it your personal life, your faith, be it your Bible studies. It will give you answers rooted in scripture, but it will also be built on that relationship over time. It will remember things that you tell it. The more you talk to it, the more personalized it gets. It develops personalized faith pathways for you, and it'll help you answer questions and find community around you so that you can discover Christian events. Josh, there's much more I could say about this product, but are you blessed or stressed by Tamagotchi, Duolingo, best friend, youth pastor, piece of technology?
I'm stressed by the name because I only hear the song Higher.
Can you take me?
Yes. That's kind of the Cookie Monster sings Creed songs.
You're welcome.
Nice little cover there. This sounds awful to me because it's like, who else are we going to replace? Now, I am very aware that this is replacing me. and maybe that's the selling point. You no longer have to talk to Josh. But this is what is happening now. We have replaced discipleship with little Tamagotchi pet. Do we have to feed Creed every 7 hours or it dies and then we have to buy a new one?
What? He gets very upset.
Gets very upset. It's a lot of 90s alternative rock. I don't know. Are you blessed or stressed?
I am stressed by this. And I think if there's one thing you can defend, it's the idea of like, okay, if we're using AI, if we're going there for information anyway, why not create a model that can help us sort of think biblically about different things? But this is just another step towards disembodied life. And you are actually not meant to go to the internet or AI or a piece of electronic equipment for life advice. You are actually meant to go to your pastor, to go to your community, to go to your actual best friend
in
real
beings.
Life.
Yes.
And I don't want to cast aspersions on the motives of these individuals that are making this stuff. I think they have the best of intentions. I think they see an opportunity in the market to hopefully be a blessing and all of that. So I'm not trying to criticize their motives, but I just think the more we are withdrawing from actual humans, yes, it's possible you might actually get better advice from the robot, but we don't need more robots. We need human beings.
Yeah, discipleship is not purely an information problem.
Yes.
And you can go to all these things for information, but discipleship is meant to be relational. And so we're replacing relationship with information, and it's such a Western, like, if I just know the right things, I'm going to do the right things. Yeah. I know a lot of things that I shouldn't do, and yet I do them anyway. It almost sounds like Paul. I know what I ought to do, and yet I choose not to.
Well, and even the relational component, one of the things that I love and hate about AI is anytime I ask it a question, which I use AI for research quite a bit, is that it immediately helps me with what I'm looking for and then makes another suggestion on how it could help me more. That's great, but also that's not how relationships work. You know, I don't know, Josh, when we hang out, you're not constantly trying to answer my questions and then provide additional help, right?
I'm trying to get out of the office as quickly as possible.
So you see the idea of going but it is a completely selfish way to view an interaction. If I was like that with you all the time, we would never hang out, and nor should we. This idea of going, all right, I'm being trained in this constant consumption of a thing that is there to always meet my needs. I don't know. It makes me nervous.
Yeah, and the way that it gets really insidious to me is that it begins to also pair back to you what you already believe, because it's going to cater to what you need.
Yeah.
You need somebody in your life who's going to challenge you beyond what you need or what you think you need into what you really need, which is something to really force you to think about things in a very different way. And I highly doubt AI is going to challenge you in really anything.
I think that's true. All right, what do you got?
All right, so at the CES convention, Consumer Electronics Show, there's a piece of tech that combines confectionery with music. Behold, the Lollipop Star, an edible gadget that plays a licensed song in your head while you eat the item. One comes with a different tune, and they cost $8.99. All you have to do is press the button at the bottom of the stem and start eating. I'm not going to use their words. Our editor at large, Lance Olenoff, tested it live at CES, who noted that despite some imperfections with volume, shocking, it's one of the oddest things we've seen at CES 2026 so far.
So the music comes through the stick, not the candy, I'm assuming.
Well, it actually, so it's confectionery. So it's bone jaw. So it vibrates through the stick and the item. So it's not sound. It's just, it's only you supposedly can hear it because it's vibrating through your skull.
This is so unbelievably stupid, but I love it so much. The idea that we have music lollipops now, that somebody thought of it, that people are paying $8 for it. It is so unnecessary and yet so funny. I am blessed by this. This is ridiculous and I love it.
A fool and their money shall part soon, or whatever that phrase is. I am.
Fool and his dough should soon split, so when you come across a fool, get all that you can get.
Dr. Dre. Dr. Dre, I love it. Yes, the 20th century philosopher. This stresses me out. The idea of just sending things through the bones of my face, just like, I don't know. Hey. What's wrong with the headphone? I don't understand.
And it's just one song.
It's just one song, and it's done. Yeah. I don't know.
It's not very economical.
No.
But hey, probably better than betting $8 on Isaiah Hartenstein scoring 8 points. So.
Unless you can get 200 bones, then I get it.
Stress you out a lot less than that. All right. Well, whether you were blessed or stressed by that, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.